KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I thought I'd do one movie for them and then hop back onto a network TV series. But Hallmark kept showing me the love. And my wife sagely said to me, "Babe, go where the love is."
In 2015, actor Christopher Polaha booked what he thought would be a one-off gig in a Hallmark TV movie. But 3 years later, he's got five Hallmark movies under his belt and is currently shooting his sixth. Are they cheesy? Sure. Does Polaha care? No. He tells us how he and the Hallmark Channel fell in love. Then KCRW's Matt Holzman took a trip to Netflix headquarters to sit down with Lisa Nishimura, the woman you have to thank for the hours you've lost to binging Making a Murderer or Wild Wild Country. The head of original documentaries and comedy programming for the streamer tells us how she decides what will become a Netflix original documentary. But first we banter. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my teammate and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Wow. You know, I will just acknowledge, we are retaping this because the news has been moving kind of quickly, and I'm specifically referring to Kevin Hart as the host of the Academy Awards. That was a very short-lived. I think somebody said it was like a fraction of a Scaramucci because it was so short. And I got to say, most people probably know by now, it is hard to hire a host for the Academy Awards because it is not a great gig. I mean, the ratings have been going down. It's much easier to fail than it is to succeed. And it's a lot of work. So that is hard. It took a while. The Academy comes up with Kevin Hart. I mean, for me, the threshold question is, how on earth did the Academy not know in this day and age that Kevin Hart has a history of homophobic tweets? And yes, he may have discontinued these in 2011, but they were still sitting there and people still knew about them, except for apparently the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
Yeah, this is a pretty big failure on their part. But the thing that I think it illustrates is what you referenced here, is that it's really difficult to find someone that checks all the box. A, they have to want to do it. And we know that The Rock passed. We know Ellen passed. We know Tina Fey and Amy Poehler have said that they don't want to do the Oscars. It's really difficult to find someone. And you want someone who brings something to the show. Kevin Hart is a legitimate movie star. He is a funny comedian. He has a gigantic following on social media. Those are all the boxes that the Academy wants checked. And I think they just got a little drunk on the idea of this and didn't do the due diligence to see if those were out there.
I have a couple of thoughts here. One is, you know, I see a lot on Twitter, they should get this person, they should get that person. But as you just pointed out, this and that person doesn't necessarily want to do it. So
yeah, I mean, the Academy has a gigantic list. They know all these people that people are suggesting, but it's usually one quick phone call and, you know, he's in Australia shooting or doesn't really think it's the right time. I talked to one publicist this week who represents a lot of comedians who said, hell no. There is so little upside for someone hosting the Oscars. The narrative is of declining ratings. The attack that you subject yourself to is gigantic because everybody loves to have an opinion. And every Oscar host from, you know, Kimmel to Hugh Jackman to James Franco and Anne Hathaway to Seth MacFarlane, they just become these punching bags for people to go after. And it's just not that worth it.
Yes. The other thought I have, however, is, okay, so Kevin Hart has a homophobia, old homophobic tweets problem. And so you sit down and you say, Kevin, you're awesome. We love you. You're amazing. We would love to have you, but we might be facing some blowback. So should there be that blowback, why don't you just say, that was then, this is now, I've evolved, I apologize for my past bigotry, not to put too fine a point on it, and I hope that I can be a role model of the tolerance and then go on the show and make fun of yourself and make fun of bigotry. That was the path. There was a way to inoculate yourself. But instead, I got to say, you know, Kevin Hart then tweets Martin Luther King this morning as if he is being martyred in all of this. I found that very offensive. I think Martin Luther King would find that very offensive.
Well, the weird thing is that he made this video saying that he refuses to apologize because he has apologized in the past and he doesn't want the internet trolls, as he put it, to win. But then he apologized when he stepped down. So the psychology at work here is bizarre. Some people suggested today, well, since he apologized, maybe the Academy will invite him back. No, I think that it is done. They will move on and, you know, they will find somebody or they will go hostless.
Yes, I don't think Kevin Hart gets invited back. I think this was overall damaging to him, and I'm sure he will have his supporters, but I think a lot of people will say, what is going on there? Speaking of what is going on there, the CBS story, it just doesn't hit bottom. It's so terrible. So first of all, we have this leaked report, a draft of the report by these investigators that were hired to look into what Leslie Moonves did and in his tenure at CBS. Their report is so shocking. I can't think of anything. I've covered this business for quite a while. I cannot think of a parallel at a major media company. It is unbelievable to me that Leslie Moonves, I mean, the thing that he tried to cover this thing up. There were people on staff apparently to serve him sexually, allegedly. I mean, this litany of misconduct. And of course, as always, the cover up is appalling. He apparently got rid of evidence. The detail that stops more people who I've talked to about this than maybe any other horrible detail is he handed over his 9-year-old son's iPad instead of his own to try to cover up for himself. And people just have called me and texted me like, I'm sorry, he handed over his child's iPad. I mean, that is one of those details that says so much.
Yeah, I mean, I bet the investigators wondered why Leslie Moonves was watching so much Paw Patrol. So the question here is, what are they going to do about this going forward? Because I think the $120 million he says he's entitled to is going bye-bye. There is no chance he's going to get this. But how far does this go? Are investigators going to start looking at all of his team and all the other people that were there and enabled this? There was apparently a resignation letter that was prepared for him that was never sent. And the employee who prepared the letter never told the board about that. And that seems like something that the board would probably want to know about. There are all kinds of other questions still open here.
Well, what we know from this draft report is the board did know about terrible behavior and shrugged. So it's a horrible look for a lot of people. I mean, the earth is scorched for some CBS executives. I don't even know whether they got payouts and will now the CBS will try to claw those back or terminate them. The other thing, of course, is the culture at CBS, because we're hearing also now they looked at 60 Minutes because that was a whole separate thing. And they weren't overjoyed with Jeff Fager's conduct when he ran the series because there were allegations of misconduct. He sent a text to one of CBS News' own staffers trying to scare her off reporting, which is just unconscionable. But also the worst stuff was Don Hewitt, who is now dead. They paid $5 million to a woman who alleged that Hewitt had relentlessly sexually assaulted her, destroyed her career. I mean, that's not a fireable offense. So now we're looking at this unbelievable scandal at this incredibly decorated and respected show. We're at this place where we've had scandals at Fox News, and CBS is right up there with Fox News. And we've had scandals at NBC. For some reason, ABC has dodged a bullet. But CBS, NBC, and Fox, and this stuff at CBS is kind of, I would say Roger Ailes is equally nefarious or more so. But that does not mean the CBS stuff is not absolutely terrible.
Yeah, and remember that Jeff Fager reported to Les Moonves, not to the head of CBS News, which is very important. And they are still paying out money to this woman who accused Don Hewitt. She is apparently getting money for the rest of her life. So if I'm a CBS shareholder and I'm sitting here looking at all of this, and there's a shareholder meeting, I believe it's on the 11th, I look at this situation and I say, okay, how do we stop this now? How do we fix this? And I believe that the CBS shareholders should be pushing for full transparency. They need to get all of the information about what happened, these reports, but also beyond that. You know, they should allow these people who have signed NDAs to get, you know, get rid of them. They should allow them to go public. They should do a full and thorough investigation, not just of what they have to look at, but beyond that. Six CBS News on it. Tell everybody at CBS News, okay, go do, you know, as much reporting on us as you want and put it all out there. I think that's the only way that they can move on from this.
I would say, you know, this woman who settled, obviously Dawn Hewitt is dead. This happened a while ago. She may not want to tell her story. She may not want to go public. But I have found covering a lot of Me Too stories myself and stories of sexual assault. We just did one about Leslie Moonves. So this woman had an encounter with him in 1985. And yet she found it cathartic, she told me, to tell that story finally, publicly. So this woman may want to tell that story. And if so, she should. And I think that absolutely CBS should release anyone from an NDA to show that they are starting to clean the house. And this is, you know, essential to having any kind of culture that can go forward and to someday clear the name of CBS. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Christopher Palaha did not see being a regular in Hallmark movies as part of his career plan. He was an actor in broadcast TV series, including North Shore on Fox and Life Unexpected on the CW. But then he took one gig on a Hallmark movie, and then another, and another. By now, he's been in five, including three of the Christmas variety. Palaha recently wrote a guest column for The Hollywood Reporter about why he now loves these movies. We invited him to read a version, which he recorded from an hour outside Vancouver, Canada, where he's currently in production for, what else, his sixth Hallmark project.
If you told me 10 years ago that I'd be a leading man in several Hallmark movies, I probably wouldn't have believed you. But that was before the whole industry changed. Well before binge-watching was even a thing, and pre the cultural tidal wave that is the Hallmark Countdown to Christmas juggernaut. I thought I'd do one movie for them and then hop back onto a network TV series, but Hallmark kept showing me the love, and my wife sagely said to me, "Babe, go where the love is." The first movie, called The Dater's Handbook, offered me the chance to work with Meghan Markle months before she met the man who would make her duchess.
I can't fight this feeling anymore.
What are you doing?
Now, this has simply become a fun fact for me, but for the record, she is wonderful, worthy of the title. In my next movie, I wanted to channel George Clooney from Up in the Air.
Brockman, if he didn't want to do it, it had to be done.
So they hired a hatchet man.
They hired someone who is not afraid to make tough decisions.
Next up was Rocky Mountain Christmas with Lindy Booth and Treat Williams, where I played a movie star doing character study on a working ranch when he unexpectedly falls in love with the rancher's daughter.
Why do you have a snowball in your hand?
Well, this was gonna be your wake-up call if you weren't up yet. It seems a shame to waste such a perfectly good snowball.
Really?
And I got to ride a horse. My fourth movie was filmed in Fiji with Jill Wagner. Yes, Hallmark sent me to Fiji.
Mr. Romance slash adventure novelist. I mean, you must have women lined up around the block.
Yeah, I do, which is why I moved into a gated community. And I just got home from making my third Christmas movie called A Small Town Christmas with Ashley Newbro, where Bill Abbott, Michelle Vickery, and Randy Pope, the folks who are running the show over at Hallmark, allowed me to play my character with a touch of Jimmy Stewart from It's a Wonderful Life. It's easy to see what a gift it has been to act for Hallmark. They've given me the freedom to make bold, even outlandish choices while earning a living. Go where the love is. Love is the core theme of every Hallmark movie. In every single movie, you can count on the leads falling in love. Even if it's a mystery, they will fall in love as they solve the case. Whether over baking, on book tours, decorating, ice skating, tree lighting, protecting old traditions or old homes, in royal palaces, or while on safari, every movie has a winning nine-act structure where the leading lady will slip in act four or five and the leading man will catch her. It's funny, you can actually play a pretty great drinking game at home based on these devices. And the audience knows what's going to happen. But oddly, it's that familiarity that's drawing in Americans Well, hold on. The Canadian W Network just made a deal to broadcast Countdown to Christmas movies simultaneously in Canada. So it's drawing North Americans into the fold at record numbers. Here's another fun Hallmark story. I was filming Condor in Toronto for MGM with William Hurt, Bob Balaban, Brendan Fraser. And the story took place in Washington, D.C. Being a recovering method actor, I took my family to D.C. to see the city and get a feel for it. We know a guy, Tim Griffin, who's the lieutenant governor of Arkansas, and he took us on this amazing private tour of the Capitol building, which included the green room where our country's senators can step off the floor for refreshments. And Tim introduced us to a woman named Miss Pat, who has worked in that room since 1968. My wife, she used to be an actress on Days of Our Lives, and Pat knew who she played, Princess Greta. And then Tim proudly introduced me, and he started listing off my work. Now, if you're an actor, it's an odd thing when this happens. People either know you or they don't. And I always feel a little awkward after the fourth or fifth job I've done has been rattled off and they still have that blank look on their face. He finally gets to the Dater's Handbook. And Pat's eyes light up. Yes, I've seen that one. And we did it. We connected over my work, a now shared experience, which is the beauty of this industry. Standing in the green room of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. And it was my Hallmark movie that did it. As an actor, I am leaning into Hallmark because it's fun to sit with my 7-year-old and show him what I do for a living. I'm leaning in because my 91-year-old Nana finally thinks I've made it in Hollywood because I'm on the Hallmark Channel. I'm leaning into them, well, frankly, because they're leaning into me and showing me the love. So, if you haven't indulged yet, perhaps this is your year to go where the love is. And always hold on when
you
get
love, so you can let go when you get it. You can see Christopher Polaha in the TV movie A Small Town Christmas, which airs December 16th on the Hallmark Channel. Coming up after a short break, Netflix VP of Original Docs and Comedy, Lisa Nishimura, explains why she prefers to watch movies at dawn. And tells us the two topics she's most often pitched at Netflix. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Documentary series weren't typically pop culture phenomena until almost exactly 3 years ago, when Making a Murderer dropped on Netflix. The buzz from that series about Stephen Avery, a man imprisoned for a rape he definitely did not commit, and then years later imprisoned again for a murder he may or may not have committed, consumed many binged hours that year and made many viewers into critics of the Wisconsin legal system. Fans of Making a Murderer or this year's Emmy-winning series Wild Wild Country have Netflix's Lisa Nishimura to thank. As head of original documentaries and comedy programming for the streamer, she oversees all kinds of formats, documentary shorts, features, and series, as well as stand-up specials. KCRW's Matt Holzman recently sat down with Nishimura at the Netflix offices in Hollywood.
I know you're very busy. Is it true that you actually get up early in the morning, like at the crack of dawn, and watch movies?
I try. Aspirationally, I do manage to get up pretty early and watch films and episodes of shows we're doing. Yeah. It's the best time.
Yeah.
Your brain is fresh.
Right.
The discipline is not checking my phone and hopping into news.
But it does seem when you started this job, it was easier because there weren't that many documentaries, and now there are so many documentaries to watch. Mm.
The thing about my gig when I first started here a little over 11 years ago was that it was quite a remarkable job because I got to work with all of the independent studios around the world, right?
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, it was the first global job. So it was documentary, it was Bollywood, it was Japanese anime, it was across every format from scripted to unscripted. It was just everything that was independent studio.
Well, we're going to talk about documentaries mostly here because
Great.
That's really my my bailiwick, and now it's yours. HBO, obviously, was a giant in funding high-profile documentaries for many years. Mm-hmm. I think they realized that it gave their network a kind of legitimacy. It gave them a legitimacy with serious audiences and with artists as well. And also, it gave them that legitimacy at a fairly low cost point. But I don't think they ever thought it was going to bring them subscribers. And I wonder, why are documentaries important to Netflix? What did they do for you?
So our proposition is pretty simple. It's what is ultimately going to bring joy to a global audience, a very, very diverse global audience. And what kind of creative environment can we support here at Netflix that brings the greatest storytellers to come and do their greatest work? And what I would say is documentary as a storytelling form, I think, has incredible levels of gravitas and appeal. So I think all the things you just mentioned with regard to HBO, certainly working with some of the world's best filmmakers, I think prestige, I think incredible engagement. And then the beauty is when that matches with the way the Netflix service works, which is personalized based on not what genre do you want to watch, because very few people wake up and say, I want to watch this movie from this studio or this genre. They want to feel a particular way. So every single piece of storytelling on Netflix, whether it's scripted or unscripted, whether it's series or feature, is provided with a series of tags for tone. It's really more feeling. Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely normal, and you've probably had this experience yourself, where you go to Netflix and you open it up and the things that are presented to you in that exact moment in time are specific to your feeling. And you might have a scripted series right next to a documentary, right next to a doc short, right next to a comedy special, because that's what we believe you're going to absolutely love in that moment. And that will change depending on the device you're on, depending upon the day of the week.
But as a business, mm-hmm. you have to make – every decision has got its cost. It's got its benefit, sure. right? And I wonder, with documentaries, what is there a specific benefit that is different than other content, or is all the same? Is there something about documentaries that brings something specifically to the network?
I think the latest statistic is around 105 million of our members have watched a documentary in the last 12 months. People are watching documentary, because I think maybe what you were inferring is that it's prestige, but maybe it's really narrow. I would argue the opposite. I would argue that we're actually getting incredibly expansive, big audiences on a global basis for a craft and a storytelling form that I think is long deserving for that. And, you know, what we get excited about is trying to figure out how can we actually take the craft of documentary and take away sort of the niche veneer that I think some people put on it, which is that it's noble, but somehow it's going to be medicine.
It's broccoli.
Or that it's important, but yeah. it's going to be a little bit painful to watch. I completely and fundamentally disagree with that. I think if we're doing our job well, we're supporting storytellers to be highly engaging, highly entertaining. And if in the process of that, you have the opportunity to occupy another person's universe, and it's wildly engaging and entertaining, and in the process, your aperture on sort of life or perspective kind of grows and changes, well, that's fantastic.
So we're talking about what documentaries kind of do for Netflix. So mm-hmm. let's talk about what Netflix does or does not do for documentaries.
Sure.
Being having such a big footprint, mm-hmm. do you think at all about when you pick a movie or you pick movies, how that affects documentary?
Well, I mean, I hope that we've been a small part of expanding people's excitement about the nonfiction storytelling craft, right? I mean, I hope that we're part of folks that would never have previously identified themselves as documentary watchers. You know, I sit in these consumer insight surveys where I listen to what members have to say about, you know, what they're watching and why they're watching it. And I love it when I hear somebody say, you know, I was halfway through this movie before I realized it was real life. And this is a person that never had watched a documentary before, but identify it now as a category that they actively seek, right? Again, because we probably presented it to them next to Stranger Things, you know?
Right.
And I love that it's actually a very rich competitive marketplace right now for documentary, because that means that it's a wonderfully fertile place for creators to continue to be pushing and making a story. And I think that's right. Great.
So if documentary filmmakers want to work with you, mm-hmm. when they come to you with a project, what is it you're looking for?
Super strong point of view. I want to hear what the story is, distinctly why that's the story that they feel they absolutely have to tell. And what is the specific vantage, storytelling vehicle innovation, if that's the thing that they want to do, if they want to utilize a new sort of form of storytelling technique or technology. I just want to understand what is their vision. For me, it's hard when somebody comes in and says, what do you want to do? I could do this, I could do that. Oh, it could be a feature, it could be a series. Oh, this is a good story, but maybe it could be a short. Because to me, then I recognize that it's not the passion, right? It's not the very, very thought through, you know, there's a discipline to this, right? Documentary is hard. You know, it's a really, really challenging craft, particularly if you're working in something that's happening currently, and you're trying to work against unfolding events. I mean, there's a level of commitment and discipline that is going to require a terrible amount of preparation and organization. And so when somebody comes in and they have a clarity of why the story has to be told, why it's important, and why they uniquely are the one individual, or that team is the individual team that is tailor-made to make it, that's extremely exciting.
But it's not like we want to make, you know, a crime serial. It isn't. We want to make a there aren't kind of like these stacks of movies that you're really interested in making.
Well, you can imagine we get a lot of crime pitches.
Yeah,
we get a few. We get a few food pitches here and there, which is, you know, they're both incredibly interesting categories. But then even the ones that are the most popular are the ones that I push back the hardest. Why? Why this one and not the 500 others that are in the ecosystem? Like, talk me through that.
Right.
And you will, you know it immediately when someone has really figured it out and cracked the code, how and why, right? Right? And that's what you're looking for.
Is it true that for a reasonably priced documentary, whatever that is, that you essentially have green light, that you can decide to do a project or not to do it?
Yep.
Is it also true that you had to fight with your boss, Ted Sarandos, over what happened to Simone? And he said it. I read it.
He said it. You read it. It's true. It's true.
Why were you so fired up about that? Why did you think that was a movie that needed to be made?
Liz Garbus, for one, remarkable filmmaker, incredible point of view, incredible level of passion about talk about, I want the story. I know I can tell the story. I have unique access. Like all those boxes that we were just talking about, she had checked in spades. You know, at the time that we were doing Nina Simone, we weren't a global company by a long shot at the moment that we were talking about greenlighting that film. And I just knew that Nina Simone was an icon, not just musically, but in civil rights. And as just as a subject so deeply fascinating on so many fronts. So I believed in it. And to Ted's credit, I think he's doing what he should do, which is push back and make me think about it. He should make all of his heads of his different, you know, divisions really, really think about and be willing to scrap and fight for the projects they believe deserve to be made. That's a great exercise for us. And to his credit, he will say, I disagree with you, but it's your call, which also means you got to own it
right.
If you don't stick the landing, right? Which we should. And that's a remarkable thing about working here. There's a tremendous amount of freedom. We do literally green light based on what we believe is in the best interest of the business. But that's why, back to the original question of how do you choose, it's constantly with the lens of what's in the best interest for our members. And our members are changing constantly, right? So in 2017, that's when the number of members ex-US outpaced the US. Now, the US is still a really significant number and will continue to grow. But if the US is 5% of the global population, if we're doing our job right, that's going to continue to grow.
Right.
So what are the stories that are going to resonate internationally, globally? Like, how do we think about that? So we're very much in the process of, frankly, listening and studying and asking a lot of questions, meeting with a lot of filmmakers around the world. And it really, in so many ways, because of that, because we're really just leaning heavily into global, it feels like we're just at the beginning of it.
Lisa Nishimura is the Vice President of Original Documentary and Comedy Programming at Netflix. Thanks for taking the time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. Subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.